As some of you heard, the state of Hawaii released my official long-form birth certificate. Hopefully, this puts all doubts to rest. But just in case there are any lingering questions, tonight, I'm prepared to go a step further. Tonight, for the first time, I am releasing my official birth video. I want to make clear to the Fox News table, that was a joke.
Hello and welcome to The Last Laugh. My name's Matt Wilstein and I'm a senior writer at The Daily Beast. On today's show, someone I have interviewed many times over the past few years. I think I can even call him a friend at this point. Crooked Media co-founder and former speechwriter for President Obama, John Lovett. John is hesitant to call himself a comedian, but he did spend several years writing jokes for Obama's White House Correspondents' Dinner speeches and performs what has been sounding more and more like stand-up on his weekly live podcast, Love It or Leave It. We taped this episode at Crooked Media headquarters in L.A., the very same studio where Pod Save America tapes twice a week, and went pretty deep on the state of political comedy as we approached the first comedy-free White House Correspondents' Dinner in 16 years. I hope you enjoy this much more political than usual edition of The Last Laugh with the very funny and very opinionated John Lovett. So yeah, I feel like your legions of fans would love to know what a typical day is like for you here at Crooked Media. So what's happening today?
Well, today, you know, it's a mix of things. Every day is a little bit different because, you know, Monday there's a Pod Save America, Tuesday Tommy records Pod Save the World, on Thursday there's another Pod Save America, and Love It or Leave It is usually Thursday night. You know, it's a mix of things. We have shows that we're always working on and thinking about, plus this is now a growing company with 30 some odd people, so there's other shows in development, questions about what else we should be doing. So it's an interesting mix between being a host and then also being part of a company and learning how to do that on the fly.
And how many Diet Cokes is this for you today?
You know, I am cutting back. So this is probably number three. What time is it now? 2:30?
2:30-ish, yeah.
But I start with a triple espresso in the morning.
Oh, so that's something too.
It's a lot. And I'm trying to cut back, but I'm not succeeding is the problem.
So we're coming up on the first White House Correspondents' Dinner without a comedian since 2003, when Ray Charles was the guest at the dinner just after the invasion of Iraq.
Wow!
So that's something to think about right there. what do you think about that decision that we heard several months ago now from the White House Correspondents' Association to forgo a comedian this year?
You know, there are people that have a unnuanced negative view of the White House Correspondents' Dinner, that it is a moment in which elite journalists pay tribute to themselves by getting too cozy with the people they're meant to cover, that it is a symptom of cultural and political rot, that it takes what should be an adversarial relationship and pulls back the curtain to reveal people that care more about access than they do about doing good journalism. That would be, I think, a version of the critique. And I think that there is some truth to that. But I also think that the dinner does have some value and when there was a president who wasn't the worst person America's produced in half a century in the job, it had value both for the president, but also for the press, in that it is a moment to remember that it's an earnest thing to say, but that we are all Americans and that we do celebrate the free press. And that as much as the relationship between the White House and the White House press corps can be adversarial, and as much as they can bother each other, ultimately there is respect and mutual regard born of a shared set of principles about what we care about and what we do and what we're supposed to care about in a democracy is open and free flow of information and powerful people understanding that it is the role of journalists to hold them accountable. And it is an opportunity to poke fun at the silliness and self-seriousness of the press corps and to afford the president a chance to point out some of the things that have been bugging him about the press. And that lets out some air, and I think that can be a good thing. I don't think it's a bad thing. Now, that being said, I do think it becomes a vulgar and ugly display when you are looking past monumental and evil sins on the part of the president. I think that is true when George W. Bush is joking about weapons of mass destruction and the Iraq War. I think that is true when you have someone like Donald Trump who is making a mockery of the office, destroying institutions, pursuing racist, supremacist, anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim policies, lying on a daily basis, attacking the press corps on a daily basis. So before Donald Trump said he wasn't going to this thing anymore, I thought that it was hard to imagine having the dinner like they always had it, because how can you sit there and laugh with these people?
Yeah.
Before we even got to Donald Trump pulling out, I was like, how can you have a comedian and tell jokes? So in a lot of ways, and I've said this before, I think I said this to you before, that this is like a zombie dinner. This is a zombie White House correspondence dinner for a zombie institution to protect zombie norms during a zombie presidency.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing that kind of precipitated this decision to not even have a... Now, there wasn't a president. Now there's not going to be a comedian either.
Right.
Was last year with Michelle Wolf when she made some jokes about Sarah Huckabee Sanders and Kellyanne Conway, which I think those got less attention. And the reaction, I guess, was to say, okay, we're not even going to have comedy at this thing anymore. And it seems like it may be a plea from the WHCA to say we're going to have this historian in a way to almost court Trump back to the dinner. Did you see it that way? Or did you think that's what they are up to? I mean, why do you think they made that decision?
I don't know. And I don't envy the position of the White House Correspondents Association. I don't envy the position of the White House Correspondents Association during this period of time.
Yeah.
But as a rule, anything you do to try to accede to Trump in order to make him feel comfortable is probably a mistake. I respect the desire to just have the dinner, because I respect that you're not going to just stop doing something that is part of your mission that you think has value simply because the politician in the White House disagrees with you. That would seem to run counter to the mission itself.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you run into this, like, what is the point of this thing? I mean, what is the point of having a comedian, right? I mean, what is the point of any of this? And especially with the White House, I actually don't know the answer to this. You know, last year, Trump didn't go, but Sanders went.
Sat up there on where the president usually sits on the dais. Yeah.
Are White House officials planning to go this year?
I don't know the answer to that either. And I think that I've heard that Trump is not planning to go, and he likes to kind of hold a rally and make fun of it from afar. That seems to be what he's been doing the last couple of years. But the fact that there's not a comedian makes me think that there's more of a chance that he would show up, because he seems so averse to being in the room when somebody is making fun of him. I mean, we've seen that, you know, over and over again.
I wonder, it seems, you know, who can predict? I don't think that the comedian, not comedian distinction is very important to them.
Mm.
They like bashing the press. It's an opportunity to say, all these reporters are gathered, but I'm here with you. And
there's
it seems like
there's plenty for them not to like without the comedian there.
And by the way, something that has been a fantasy option for Democratic and Republican presidents for a long time. This idea that you just say, I'm not going to that dinner. I'm going to the people.
Yeah.
Right. Like, why not make a moment of it? You know, I don't know how many presidents have gotten close to doing it, but it is something that you feel like was an option that people would consider. Like, don't go to that fancy dinner. Go do a rally and say you're not going. Make a moment of it. Make a anti-elite, anti-Washington moment of it. But they finally did it. And I think partly it is because he wants to bash the press. Partly it is because he has thin skin. Oh, and one other thing, by the way, one other piece of this is one of the other, I think, reasons you have it and also reasons to question why it exists is it was also bipartisan. It was something where you had Democrats in the audience and Republicans in the audience, and they would laugh and poke fun at each other, and maybe some jokes would go too far, maybe they wouldn't. But now, how can you justify saying that these people belong in a room together when we have one of our two parties that has so abandoned principle to get behind the president. So, you know, the White House Correspondents' Dinner, maybe we're in this period where you got to just shake the Etch-a-Sketch. And that's what this is. These years will be a moment to shake the Etch-a-Sketch, because by the time you got to the end of the Obama years, the thing had become so sensationalized. There were so many parties. There were so many celebrities. The true kind of purpose of the dinner had been so far removed from what was actually happening anyway. So honestly, who gives a shit?
And I'm never really sure what to call Sarah Huckabee Sanders. You know, is it Sarah Sanders? Is it Sarah Huckabee Sanders? Is it Cousin Huckabee? Is it Auntie Huckabee Sanders? Like, what's Uncle Tom but for white women who disappoint other white women? Oh, I know, Aunt Coulter. I actually really like Sarah. I think she's very resourceful. Like, she burns facts, and then she uses that ash to create a perfect smoky eye. Like, maybe she's born with it. Maybe it's lies. It's probably lies.
As someone, you went to a lot of these things. As you said, you wrote jokes for Obama. When you saw everything that happened with Michelle Wolf and, you know, Mercedes Schlapp storming out of the room and tweeting about it and all that.
She wanted to get to the party faster. Yeah.
Did you think, wait, were these jokes any harsher than any other jokes that anyone else had made? Did you think that they were crossing some line?
No. And I think Michelle Wolf is incredibly funny. I think she's incredibly talented. I think she gave these people the hard-edged humor that doesn't come close to the level of vitriol, misinformation, and hatred that they have directed at not just powerful opponents, but powerless people. You know, there was some suggestion that she was talking about people's appearances. I think that was very debatable. And I would argue in general, not about Michelle Wolf, that, and again, really this is not about Michelle Wolf, that as a rule, I think it is valuable to go really hard at these people, and it is also valuable to keep it on the substance because they deserve it, and it prevents them from making deeply bad faith attacks against you when these are people that apologize for, work for, help every single day. One of the most vicious, mean-spirited people who attacks appearance and women and their bodies on a near constant basis. So my view of it is, I think that they were going to try to find something to say Michelle Wolf did was wrong. They were going to find something that Michelle Wolf did wrong, no matter what she did. Mm-hmm. You know, I think what she did was probably close to the line. That's where she was supposed to be. And by the way, when you're a comedian and your goal is to try to get close to the line and really push these people, if there's a chance you may step over it, who gives a shit? So what? It's a joke. But they don't care. And they don't care either. They're so hurt. Give me a fucking break. These are people that work for Donald Trump, who help Donald Trump every single day, who mocks people and who is not joking, who is not trying to get people to laugh, who isn't doing it to make light, who isn't doing it to hold the powerful accountable, who's doing it to hurt people's feelings and make people feel small and turn his supporters against them and keep his supporters from feeling compassion for some of the least among us. You know, recently, Donald Trump made fun of asylum seekers. Now, you can tell me that you are hurt by Michelle Wolf making a joke about, I don't even remember, eyeshadow. But yeah. you're so hurt you have to leave a party and get to the after party faster because it just made you feel so sad. And yet Donald Trump trying to get his supporters to not care about asylum seekers escaping poverty and crime with the and threats to their lives with the clothes on their back, making fun of them, saying that they're fakers. That doesn't bother you, it's bullshit.
Yeah. So, I mean, Trump's feelings about comedy are well known. He tweets about SNL, including recently, I think his SNL rage culminated in a tweet about a rerun from Christmas that he, I think, somehow either watched or heard about and then complained about again. And threatened NBC, and he's going to take away licenses. I mean, what do you think that's about? Do you think, like, what is...
What do I think it's about?
Yeah.
I think he thought it was a new episode. I mean, he did say, like, they're doing this over and over again. Yeah. Do you remember that clip of Donald Rumsfeld during the Bush administration saying, you're not seeing 10 vases, you're seeing one vase 10 times. They're just replaying the clip. Mm. Donald Trump did not know that. They were replaying the clip. It was a rerun. And as a rule, Saturday Night Live reruns should not have this much power in our politics. He saw a rerun on television. It got him all spun up. And he spent a week talking about John McCain. We spent a week talking about John McCain as a result. He has threatened NBC and their license before. You know, the thing with Donald Trump is he issues, you know, it's you know, fascism for the cameras. So, you know, he says he's going to shut the border down. He says he's going to go after their licenses. He says he's going to get the post office to go after the Washington Post. He says this, he says that. And usually he's just saying it. Mm-hmm. But once in a while, he means it. Once in a while, he shuts down the southern border for a few hours. Once in a while, he actually follows through with one of these idle threats, or eventually he does. You know, so it's, you have to take him quite seriously while at the same time recognizing that he wasn't thinking, he wasn't planning, he wasn't imagining the policy. He was spouting off because he's an angry old man who's slowing down and can't believe that after his entire life of seeking the respect of people in Manhattan, after his whole life of trying to get these people to like him, though unwilling to do the work and show the discipline required to get it, he is the president of the United States, and he still doesn't have people's respect. And I think deep down, he knows he doesn't deserve it, and that's who he's mad at.
Yeah.
He's mad at Donald Trump.
Yeah. Every time he makes fun of, or every time he goes after SNL, I think about how he hosted SNL, you know, less than 4 years ago during the primary. And I think that's a decision that show and Lorne Michaels and everyone is still living down in a lot of ways, and I'm not sure they've really acknowledged what a mistake that was. I mean, what did you think of that at the time, and do you think that they deserve criticism for giving him that type of platform?
Absolutely. Of course they do. Of course they do. Shame on them. Shame on them. You know, he came down that escalator and he said Mexicans are rapists. He came down that escalator and he began one of the most despicable campaigns in modern American history. It wasn't a joke. It wasn't funny then. It is a sign of, it is an example of what we allow when you talk about the right people or the wrong people versus what we allow when you don't. I mean, look, if Donald Trump said the same kinds of things about gay people that he said about Mexicans, he said the same kind of thing about Jews as he said about Muslims, there would be no chance that he could host Saturday Night Live. Of course not. Of course not. And I think it was a mistake. I understand why they made it. And by the way, it was a moment when we were grappling with something, which is, what do you do when America, one of its two political parties, embraces someone who is morally unacceptable? That when the two pillars of our political system, the two poles of the debate that are meant to be equal and opposite, duking it out in a marketplace of ideas, right? What do you do when one of those parties embraces something reprehensible to the point where it doesn't deserve to be treated like an ordinary political movement, doesn't deserve to be treated with the same respect you would afford a Democrat, right? What do you do? I don't know the answer. You definitely don't let them host Saturday Night Live. And I think one of the things you see is frustration on the part of liberals on Twitter is how can it's this idea of normalizing. Remember that we were talking about normalizing for 2 years?
Yeah.
Hey, you know why we stopped talking about it? Because it became normal.
Yeah.
But it was this feeling of, wait a second, what's more important, right? Treating Republicans or Democrats as equal or reflecting the fact that they're not, right? What's more important? And I think that they really fucked up.
Yeah, I mean, I think they thought that, oh, well, he's never going to be president. This is just a fad, and it's funny now. And you know, it's like how Huffington Post put him in the entertainment section, right, and those kinds of things.
And so, you know, look, I think it was a mistake. Obviously, it's a mistake in hindsight. I think I'm probably over-torquing how obvious it was as a mistake at the time. Though I think it speaks to the fact that I think if you had a more diverse group of people making the decision, it wouldn't have been made that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember Huffington Post putting them in the entertainment section. We didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
We didn't know what to do. We couldn't believe it was real. Mm-hmm. Couldn't believe. Somebody, I think Nate Silver made this point that as human beings, we naturally, when it comes to probabilities, we can understand the numbers in some abstract sense, but in a gut way, there's really only two probabilities, 50-50 or one in a million. Like when that coin goes up, it's 50-50. When you know, if it was 1 in 3, you'd still have that same feeling, right? Mm-hmm. Like I could win, I could lose. You know, your body can't manifest so many subtleties in terms of probabilities. And so we sorted Donald Trump into the 1 in a million category when he belonged in the 50-50 category. And I think that was a collective mistake.
Yeah. The irony about how much he hates SNL is that I think they've actually really struggled to figure out how to make comedy about him. And, you know, there was this idea that, oh, Trump's going to be so easy to make comedy about, and, you know, everything he does is an easy target. But, I mean, to my mind, it's so crazy and over the top that it becomes really hard to elevate. So what you end up doing is they just kind of restage whatever just happened. What's your take on that? I mean, I don't know how much of this stuff you watch, whether it's SNL or he also, you know, complains about Colbert and Kimmel and these people. So
a lot of people for him to complain about. I think it's a challenge for everybody. I see some things. I don't know. I'm not watching that much of it. In part because I spend all day reading about it. It's not like it's my free time.
Yeah, and you don't need to see it recreated.
I just deleted Twitter from my phone, so that Twitter was only for work. I'm in the process of trying to narrow the window politics has, because I think politics has sucked up so much of our lives. But it is hard to make fun of Donald Trump because he is a parody of himself. And that always makes it tricky to find an access point. I also think it is hard to differentiate yourself because it's a little bit like aiming at the ground. You know, I think there's a lot of people out there that are just, there's a lot of easy jokes you can make about Trump. Mm-hmm. And some of them are even pretty funny. But it's harder to find the deeper stuff, especially because we've been at this for 2 years. I mean, this is a problem not just for comedy. This is a problem for political coverage. What do you do when what do you do when the problem is obvious and has been stated again and again for 2 years? How many times can you have the same conversation? Donald Trump is unfit to be president. The Republican Party shouldn't have capitulated to him, but out of cravenness and zeal and ideological commitment and hatred of liberals, they gave in to this person, if not embraced him, and it has made our politics toxic. It has drawn all of us into it, and it sucks. we just have this conversation again and again. Oh, I can't believe they're going to confirm, I don't know, pick the villain of the week. I can't believe they're going to confirm Stephen Moore. I can't believe they're going to confirm Brett Kavanaugh. I can't believe they're not going to overturn Donald Trump's emergency declaration. I can't believe it. Of course you can believe it. It's been the same story. It's been the same story since summer of 2016. The Republican Party was never Paul Ryan's. It was Donald Trump's. And the only person who Donald Trump figured that out first. And the rest of us have been catching up.
Coming up after the break, John Lovett shares his complicated feelings about the allegations against Al Franken and Joe Biden. It does feel like if there's anything that's going to draw attention away from the Trump show, it's the 2020 Democrats, who some of whom have been able to draw attention away from him in a media sense. You guys have been interviewing them on Pod Save America. I know you've had some on Love It or Leave It. Is there anyone as people have been announcing that anyone that's really surprised you or that you've thought, you know, oh, I didn't really think I would be responding to their message or their whole approach as much as you thought you would?
You know, I'll say one thing. I am a sucker for an announcement video. I see an announcement video and I think that's it. I'm in. For about 15 minutes, there's a halo effect for me in every single announcement video. Yeah. You show me Cory Booker's announcement video, I am pumped. You show me Kamala's video, I am pumped. Show me Warren's video, I'm pumped. So I love every slogan for 15 minutes, I'm in. I think it's in part because a lot of these candidates have a great case to make. Now, surprise, I am fascinated by the little moment, I'm fascinated by the moment Pete Buttigieg is currently having. I would say, honestly, the thing that to me has been just personally the most inspiring has been Elizabeth Warren's policy proposals. I just have been, obviously, I think she has been an intellectual leader, certainly on economic issues, but I think in a larger way for Democrats for a long time. I think she was ahead of the curve in a lot of ways. And I think she kind of connects the mainstream wing of the Democratic Party with the Bernie wing of the Democratic Party. But I had no idea that basically every week she'd be laying out policy proposals that I think will ultimately form the the platform of the Democratic Party, if not now, in the future, no matter what happens in this campaign. I mean, on monopoly, on taxes, on holding corporate abusers accountable, she has just been ferocious. You know, Donald Trump, along with racism and misogyny, he talked about immigration and he talked about trade. Those were the two policies that I think animated his campaign. And yes, they are nationalist and they do allow him to put forward this sort of white supremacist ideology. But they also happen to be places where there was a consensus in the political elite, right? Mm-hmm. On trade, on immigration. So I think that there's a lesson there. And I think I've been very inspired by the way Elizabeth Warren has tried to speak to that problem without acceding even one inch on identity or any other questions while pursuing a bold economic vision.
Joe Biden is having a moment right now that I'm sure he's not enjoying very much. And it goes along with this generational question where Mayor Pete Buttigieg is getting a lot of energy behind him because he does represent this generational shift.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the things that Biden is dealing with in terms of, women saying that they made him uncomfortable, if not in a sexual way, is a generational thing too. How important do you think that is for this election, that there be a generational contrast with Trump?
You know, the way I think about it is, and we had a conversation about these questions around, you know, about Joe Biden on Positive America.
Yeah, yeah.
But to the broader question about the generational shift. To me, I think we can have a change agent in a 75-year-old body. I think we can have a change agent in a 37-year-old body.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I don't care about the generation of the person we nominate. I care about how they sound, what they call for, and if their politics reflect what is happening in the country. You can be a stodgy old person stuck in your ways. You could be a stodgy 37-year-old stuck in your ways.
Mm-hmm.
You can be my aunts Adele and Uncle Lou, they retired decades ago. These are two people who made the most out of their retirement. They try new things. They learn how to use the computer. They're cool. Some people stuck in their ways. They never learned to use Twitter. What I want to know is that the candidate we pick understands the shifts we have in the country, mm-hmm. even if maybe they're not a part of it because they're older. And by the way, you can be there are senators who have spent decades in the Senate who, I would say Sherrod Brown, I don't know how long Sherrod Brown's in the Senate. He's been in the Senate a long time. To me, I hear Sherrod Brown talk about politics, and I think it's somebody who has a connection to the people he represents, who doesn't sound like he's been on the floor of the Senate for 20 years. You can be in the Senate for 2 years and pick up those habits. So to me, I think age represents something, but it doesn't have to define something. So I'm open to the full. And look, as somebody who routinely attacks baby boomers on my podcast, I think I'm showing incredible amounts of growth.
Yeah, you are. the Biden situation, to me recalls a little bit of what happened with Al Franken, even though I think that some of the allegations against Al Franken were more severe than what people are saying about Biden. And the first episode of the show was with Sarah Silverman,
mm-hmm.
who's friends with Al Franken. And she basically said that her friendship with him made it impossible for her to understand that he did something wrong in these cases. And she really defended him and said that she thought the allegations were bullshit and that he shouldn't have had to resign and all that. I'm curious because you worked in the White House with, Obama and Biden. Do you struggle with that same kind of thing when you know the person, and maybe you have the same feeling about Al Franken? Cause I know he was you've talked about how he's a political and comedy hero of yours as well. How do you kind of deal with those personal aspects of these stories?
I think it's hard. You know, I think it's hard because, first of all, when you know somebody, and I don't feel, I don't know either of these people. You know, I to me, I think it probably makes it harder for people that feel very close to these mm-hmm. senators, especially people that love and admire Al Franken. I mean, I can take the Al Franken example. It was devastating to me when that was going on, because truly I looked up to Al Franken, and like, I loved his books. I loved the way he talked about politics. I really admired the way he transitioned from comedy into politics. I believed he was one of the most valuable Democratic voices in the Senate. It was heartbreaking for me how that unfolded, not because Al Franken was railroaded, but because Al Franken put himself in a situation where he decided he had to resign.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's a lot of people who have unfairly attacked Senator Gillibrand about this, saying, yeah. you know, how could you do that to Al Franken? What did she do? She did it to Al Franken. No, she looked at the facts as we knew them at the time, as we still know them, and said, I believe that this person should resign. Now, Al Franken had a choice to make. He could have fought. He could have waited. But he chose not to. And he chose not to in a way that kind of elided the allegations themselves. You know, I remember some differently. I apologize for the, you know, it was a kind of confusing apology like thing that happened with him. Mm-hmm. So, I go back and forth, not on the question of, was it wrong for people to call on Al Franken to resign? I go back and forth on this challenge we have of like, well, so how do we adjudicate these hard questions, right? Like, what is the right thing to do in that circumstance? You know, by the time Al Franken resigned, there were multiple allegations, including from, I'd have to go back and review the facts, but mm-hmm. but I believe a Democratic congressional staffer, which was enough, I think, to say to people, hold on, there's really is a lot here.
Yeah.
I think one of the things we were grappling with, we still are grappling with, but that was at the very peak of when we were first starting to kind of reckon with this yeah. Me Too moment.
I think the timing had a lot to do with how that all played out, for sure.
Probably. Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
But what do you do when you have built up so much injustice in a culture, right? So much that it all starts pouring out. You know, there's part of the reason you can end up in a situation where all of a sudden you are learning about multiple allegations of misconduct. And this runs the gamut from the serial predators all the way to people accused of sexual harassment, right? The more kind of quotidian misconduct, right? That's still terrible, but doesn't rise to the level of someone like Harvey Weinstein. What do you do, right? When this level of misconduct was allowed to build up because the rules just didn't apply to everybody fairly, that somebody could repeatedly abuse their position of power and not be held accountable to the point where now you're not talking about one allegation, you're talking about a dozen, you're talking about seven, you're talking about whatever number. And, you know, I think we're still reckoning with that. We're still reckoning with how you make up for the mistakes and omissions and injustices of the past. And it's really hard. And I understand those who see it differently on Franken. But, you know, I think the one thing that's important is that Democrats aren't like Republicans and we hold ourselves to a higher standard.
Yeah, I mean, people always go back to the fact that Trump has been accused of doing much worse than either Al Franken or Biden. And so people would say, you know, so why shouldn't Biden get to run against Trump?
And you know what? That is a rhetorical question that nobody wants to answer. Yeah. What exactly is your position? Is your position that Democrats don't care about misconduct? Is your position that as long as you agree with someone on policy, it doesn't matter what they do? No, of course not. So what's your position exactly? Your position is you don't like how this ended. Neither yeah. do I. I was heartbroken by it. But I don't know how we get out of this and uphold the principles we care about without recognizing that that means it's going to come down on our side and probably worse than the other side because they don't give a shit.
Yeah.
They'll get, you know, Ronna Romney McDaniel at the RNC will throw money behind Roy Moore after it all comes out, right? I don't know. All I know is, I don't want to live in a society where we're both living up to Ronna Romney McDaniel standards. I don't want to. So we shouldn't.
So another...
you are bringing up just the... What is this podcast? What exactly are we doing here? Is it just the most frustrating and awful topics? What else is on there? What else you got?
Do you want to talk about something else frustrating? I know
sure.
I have something else frustrating. Yeah. That you,
what else you got?
You wrote an open letter to Howard Schultz earlier this
year.
Yeah,
I did. You bet. Oh, my God. Jesus. What is this hit list of yours? Yes, I did. That's actually, that to me is, requires a less nuance. What do you got?
What is it that frustrates you so much about Howard Schultz?
So I would urge everyone listening to read the open letter I wrote to Howard Schultz on Crooked.com, because it does explain exactly where I'm coming from. But the larger question, why does it? So I make the argument for why Howard Schultz should run as a Democrat or not at all. But why does Howard Schultz bother me so much? He has power. His money gives him power. We have created a culture and a society in which wealth has accrued to a few privileged hands, to the hands of people like Howard Schultz, to the hands of people like Mark Zuckerberg, to the hands of people like the Koch brothers. And money is power. You can buy things with it. You can skip steps that other people can't. You can get your kids into USC if you want. That power comes with responsibility, as Spider-Man would say. And, you know, he could do whatever he wants with his money. He can decide that he doesn't have to listen to anybody. He doesn't have to do the hard work. Look at Pete Buttigieg, right? How is Pete Buttigieg making a name for himself? He doesn't have, I mean, now he has millions of dollars because people donated to him. But when he started, he was just a gay vet mayor from South Bend, Indiana, who was really fucking smart and had something to say. And he said, you know what? I'm going to take a chance and I'm going to say it. I'm going to go door to door. I'm going to go to Iowa. I'm going to go to every town hall. I'm going to answer every question. And I'm going to see what people think when they hear what I have to say. And you know what? He's having a moment. He's able to reach people. Because he couldn't skip the Democratic primary by buying his way onto every state ballot. He couldn't avoid the hard work of persuading people, for convincing people of his way of thinking, because all he has to do is buy advertisement, buy consultants to help him make dumb internet videos with jazz in the background. He gets to skip all that stuff because of his wealth. He doesn't have to listen to any of us. And, you know, that really frustrates me. It frustrates me that somebody could interject themselves into our political process and decide, you know what, I'm not going to run as a Democrat because the Democrats aren't going to agree with what I have to say. So I'm going to run as an independent, even though the next person to be elected president is going to largely be elected, if they're not Donald Trump, by Democratic votes with some independents and a few Republicans, right? It is almost certain that the next president will be elected by that group of people. And I don't care what anybody says. I don't care what the polls say. I have my own polls that I bought with my own money. I don't care what the what the best political people say, because I bought my own political people who are telling me it's a good idea for me to run. I don't care what anyone says. I don't have to care, because I have the money to not care. And that really, really bothers me. It bothers me. And, you know, one of the reasons, as I said earlier, I'm so excited by what Elizabeth Warren is doing is because she's attacking the structural unfairnesses, the structural inequities in our economy that not only means corporations have too much power over their workers, that not only mean corporations have too much power over individuals, it means that individuals can accrue so much wealth that they have more power over our political system than anyone ever intended. And you know what? Look at Mike Bloomberg, right? Mike Bloomberg, he has more money than Howard Schultz. If you add up the money that Howard Schultz has to the money Mike Bloomberg has, you end up with the amount of money Mike Bloomberg has. Mike Bloomberg is so filthy rich, and he wants to be president. You can see it in those eyes.
Yeah.
He's got those eyes that say, I want to be president. Those shark eyes. Built a massive company. He could do what Schultz is doing. He could put himself on every ballot. He could skip the Democratic primary, but he is surrounded by people who he trusts and who he listened to, who didn't tell him yes, who said, you know what, actually, you can't win as an independent. You should consider running as a Democrat or not at all. And if you're not going to run as a Democrat, you should use the money to help Democrats win. That's the best way to help the country. And you know what? He looked at that and he said, you're right. You're right, because I'm a better billionaire than Howard Schultz. I make Howard Schultz look like a piece of shit, because I'm Mike Bloomberg, the better billionaire. And Howard Schultz, too arrogant to get it. I could rant about this for a while.
What do you make of some at least one former Obama staffer working for Howard Schultz now? It seems a little incongruous to a lot of people.
I think it's incongruous to a lot of people, and I think those Democrats who think it's a good idea to help Howard Schultz need to be persuaded that what they're doing will hurt Democrats, even if now at this point, if Howard Schultz doesn't run. Because look what Howard Schultz is doing. He's traveling across the country, attacking Democrats, attacking Democratic positions, saying that being for Medicare for All is un-American. He said this. He said, Donald Trump saying he's going to shut down the southern border is just another example of bipartisan dysfunction. What are you talking about? what are you talking about, you coffee dunce?
One other candidate that I want to talk about before we move on from 2020 is Beto, because I got to see the documentary Running with Beto at South by Southwest that Crooked Media was involved in producing. What did that entail, and what did that mean to produce that documentary?
So, basically, 2 years ago, I lost all track of time, but long before anybody had ever heard of Beto O'Rourke, right before Beto O'Rourke was a household name, back when I was saying Beto, because I had no idea how to say it. This director, David Modigliani, is very talented. He made a film called Crawford about George W. Bush. A lot of people have seen. Actually knows Tommy Vitor from childhood. He's like, I'm thinking about making a documentary about this long shot Senate bid against Ted Cruz. What do you guys think? We thought about it and we're just like, you know what? Let's get involved. It seems exciting. And exciting not because we were so enamored of Beto O'Rourke, who, again, we had barely heard of, but because it was going to be a story about a long shot campaign and about people getting involved in that campaign. You know, in that movie, it's not just about Beto. He follows a woman who cares about veterans issues because of how it impacted her family, young Latina who is campaigning for Beto because she cares about immigration. So it was a story not just about, it wasn't a story about a presidential candidate. Nobody even knew who he was. It was a story about this long shot campaign and people trying to get involved in the wake of Donald Trump winning. And it just, it's one of those things where we said yes to something and then Beto O'Rourke became Beto O'Rourke and it's been very exciting. But there've been people like, oh, you know, it's, you guys have some financial stake in Beto O'Rourke becoming president. So first of all, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a documentary. I don't know if you've heard, but it's not. It's a documentary. Not a lot of people be like, oh, how'd you build this castle? I mean, I built it with documentary money. But also, we're donating any profits, if there are ever profits, which there probably won't be, to vote.org. But in part because we are going to be a place where all the candidates can come and talk.
Yeah, you don't want to be seen as kind of endorsing candidate this early on.
No.
It does. The movie is really great, and it does kind of it does work in a way as a long campaign ad for Beto O'Rourke, even though it shows a very complicated.
You
person.
See all sides of the. Yeah. I really.
Which I like. I mean, that makes me more inclined to you know support him because he seems like a human being.
Yes. I mean, that's the goal, right, of any documentary, right? So you get to see Beto as a human being behind the scenes. You get to see how this long shot campaign unfolded and the people that helped do it. And it's a really great film. So people should check it out.
Do you see some Obama in him? I mean, there's obviously been some comparisons in his style and his the way he's able to appeal to a wide swath of voters.
Isn't there a little Obama in all of us?
Oh, great answer.
Thank you.
Coming up, is John Lovett a comedian? And what was it like writing jokes for the President of the United States? You asked what this podcast is, and it's
can't wait to find out.
Ironically, it's mostly about comedy, and that's not what we've been talking about most of this time. But I do think there's this. I've mostly interviewed comedians, and I think you have this interesting place where you are. I'm curious whether you at all consider yourself a comedian, because on Love It or Leave It, I feel like especially over time, your intro monologues have gotten a little longer. They've felt a little more like stand-up comedy. Do you feel like a comedian?
Do I feel like a comedian? You know, that's an interesting question. I feel very lucky that I get to do this job where I talk about politics. I get to do it in a funny way. I get to be part of Pod Save America. I get to do this live show where I do you know, some version of stand-up once a week and do these road shows. You know, it's funny. When I was a speechwriter and then a screenwriter, I always had trouble saying I'm a writer. There's something about I'm a writer that, like, if you weren't sitting at a typewriter writing novels, like, I always felt like I was posing. And even now, like, I aspired to be a comic at one point in my life. And was doing open mics and, you know, was doing bringer shows in New York and getting friends to come to comedy clubs so that I could have a few minutes on stage, because it was something that I aspired to. And I say, even though a lot of what I get to do at Love It or Leave It is, you know, is comedic, and I look like a comedian some of the time, and there's something about saying I'm a comedian that I feel like, in the same way that I didn't feel like, I just don't feel like I get to say it. I don't know why. That may speak to more of my own Jewish anxieties.
I mean, you're still incredibly busy with everything, so I wonder whether
I'm not a comedian, I'm just busy.
whether you have aspirations to do stand up in a more stand up-y way, you know, than what you're doing on Love It or Leave It, or are you so consumed with what you're doing that you don't really have time to think about that?
Yeah, I think that I used to say, I had a friend in D.C., and I remember when I started writing jokes for Hillary, and then I started writing jokes for Obama. I remember telling him, you know, don't let me forget. You know, I know that I'm writing jokes, but maybe I'm funny enough to be a funny professional, but I'm not funny enough to be professionally funny. Mm-hmm. That was always sort of the thing I wanted to remind myself of. I was always insecure about that. I feel very lucky that I get to sit at this intersection between politics and comedy, that I get to do a show that, look, we'll have a conversation with Adam Schiff about Mueller that is, you know, very much comedy adjacent. Mm-hmm. And then we'll do a game that's purely funny. And we have great writers who help us write, you know, segments that are, you know, purely comedic. I feel very good that I get to do both. I have been very lucky in my career to never find myself easily fitting into a category, and I guess I get to keep doing that because of how lucky I've been so far.
Mm-hmm. So before we end, something I wanted to do is kind of going back to the White House Correspondents' Dinner and your experience there is, mm-hmm, go through, I believe you were there, you did four years of that,
I worked on, even after you left the White House. Yeah, I kept working on them. So I've worked on virtually all of them, but I was there in the building for the first couple.
So I wanted to go through those years as comedians and see what you remember from that time, if there's any mm-hmm, funny stories or memories that kind of pop up.
Okay.
So the first one was with Wanda Sykes, mm-hmm, which I guess was in 2009. So what do you remember from that first one?
So I barely remember Wanda Sykes because that was my first year working for President Obama and my first year working on jokes. So I was just terrified. I just was terrified. And I feel like after Obama was done, I was so relieved that I don't think I could hear things clearly. I remember her being really good, and I love Wanda Sykes. But I don't really remember her speech because I was just so relieved that Obama's went well, because I was like, I'd never written a White House correspondent speech before. You know, I never worked on one before. And so it was just very exciting. So that is all that I retain from 2009. I don't actually believe I had an official ticket. I think I just had to stand in the back.
Oh, wow. So the next year was Jay Leno was the comic, which is kind of funny to think about that Jay Leno followed Wanda Sykes. So you'd been there a little bit longer that year. So, I mean, what do you remember, not just about him, but about that year?
I remember, so that's 2010.
Yeah.
When is Big Effing Deal? I think that's the next year. Big Effing Deal with the Bleep. Mm-hmm. It might have been that year. I remember Jay Leno doing material that felt like it was from The Tonight Show, including with like video and stuff.
Yeah.
And remember thinking that I was very much in a pro Conan mindset at the time. Mm-hmm. That's all I really remember. Mm-hmm. I don't really remember that.
Yeah,
much.
That was right around that time.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then I guess Conan came in and did it later after you'd left the White House.
But, oh yeah, yeah.
But that was Leno's year. So the following year, 2011, obviously a very consequential.
This one
year.
I remember very well. Sure.
So it was Seth Meyers and Donald Trump was in the audience, mm-hmm, and both Seth and Obama made some very funny jokes about him.
Yeah.
So what comes to mind when you think about that year? Obviously, you've been asked about this one a lot more.
Yeah. So, I mean, a couple things. One, I remember that we had written most of the White House Correspondents' Dinner speech before, that was the week that the long form birth certificate was released. Mm-hmm. So he had written most of the speech, and then 2 or 3 days before the actual event, I remember Favreau and I were talking about, there was some kind of mysterious press thing that was going to happen. And I remember us joking, it's going to be the birth certificate because it's going to ruin our jokes. Like, the birth certificate is going to happen right now. And then sure enough, it was the birth certificate. And we had to rewrite a ton of stuff because a lot of it was geared about the fact that, you know, here was Donald Trump in the audience demanding a birth certificate, you know, and then all of a sudden now we have it. So we had to redo that. That was when we had the song I'm a Real American play over the video, over the image of the birth certificate. That's the year we had President Obama show his long form birth video, which was just Simba from The Lion King being
yeah,
born.
I love that one.
That was also, Judd Apatow, who I had met at the previous year. Actually, mm-hmm. I could have told this during the 2009 yeah. or 10 version. I was still so nervous about working in the White House that I was like, I was about to go in to see the president to work on jokes with, I think it was Favreau and it was Axelrod. We're about to go in. And Judd Apatow was on a tour of the White House at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, well, I'm here to help with jokes if you want. And of course, like, I think that's so cool. Like, Judd Apatow yeah. wants to help us write jokes. And I was so nervous. I was like, well, what am I supposed to do? Who do I tell? I don't know how to help. I don't know. Should he meet the president? What do I do? Mm-hmm. I was so panicked that I just said, okay, thank you. And I turned around and walked away. And he told a story later that he felt like I blocked him from meeting President yeah. Obama. Anyway, the next year I was like, you know what? I'm going to call him and he's going to help me. Yeah, I'm going to ask for his help, even though I snubbed him.
Mm-hmm.
But we got on the phone, and that is where a lot of those Donald Trump jokes came from. Judd, sort of riffing on The Apprentice and sort of a lot of good stuff came out of that conversation. But that is where a lot of the Donald Trump stuff came from. It was actually much longer and it was crazy. And I remember we weren't sure if it was going to work. And then, President Obama started delivering it and it worked. We cut it down. We made that sort of run about, how qualified Donald Trump was to be president. We made jokes about the birth certificate, all of it. And, we thought to ourselves, well, there, we've done it. We'll never hear from Donald Trump again. That was also the weekend of the Bin Laden raid.
Yeah.
So it was a consequential moment. Then Seth got up and just finished him. So
yeah. I remember, I mean, the main image I have from that that night is the shots of Trump in
from
the audience.
From the side, from the behind. You don't have the front shot.
Yeah, yeah, just that profile, not smiling, just looks like he's furious. And I wonder whether he knew he was on camera, but it's like most people in that situation would try to laugh.
Well, most people aren't the worst person our pop culture has produced in 100 years. So he's not that.
And then I think this was your last year actually working in the White House was 2012 with Jimmy Kimmel.
So I think I was probably gone by then already,
oh, really?
But I did remember working on it. I will say, now that we even sit here talking about it, 2011 has so obliterated
yeah.
all my other memories of those years. I'd have to go back and see the speech.
Mm-hmm.
There was just a run of really good, you know, Kimmel did great. Seth Meyers did great. Wanda Sykes did great. Like, there was just a run of great comics. And I, you know, I think President Obama did a great job as well. So there was just like a run of great dinners.
Yeah, I've always been curious about the decision to have the comic follow Obama, because I think with any other president, it would make sense because they're just like, obviously the professional comedian should go second. But Obama was so good at telling jokes that it almost I felt bad for the comedian who had to follow him.
It was brutal, 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 brutal. I was very proud of that too. I was proud to get to work on those speeches because it was awesome that just like, man, President Obama who is too good looking and charming to be as funny as he is, it's very frustrating, right? He should be worse at it. Was very good at delivering jokes.
All kidding aside, obviously we all know about your credentials and breadth of experience. For example, no, seriously, just recently in an episode of Celebrity Apprentice, at the steakhouse, the men's cooking team did not impress the judges from Omaha Steaks. And there was a lot of blame to go around, but you, Mr. Trump, recognized that the real problem was a lack of leadership. And so ultimately, you didn't blame Little John or Meatloaf. You fired Gary Busey. And these are the kind of decisions that would keep me up at night.
And just, I remember that this idea of like having to follow him was so hard and made it such a losing proposition. I think Seth Meyers had, to me, the best technique was he came with a binder full of jokes and he just raced through those jokes. Just joke, 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 just to keep the audience laughing, keep mm-hmm. them moving, which was, I think, a great technique to follow President Obama with.
Do you remember any jokes that you wrote that didn't make it to into Obama's speeches for any reason that you can share with us now?
I can't, not because I'm being coy. I don't remember. In part because, you know, I would write jokes and then we'd have all this huge assembly of jokes and we kind of cobble the speech together mm-hmm. and rewrite and all the rest. So I have trouble remembering who wrote what anyway, and I wouldn't want to take credit to begin with. And then the jokes that don't make, what jokes made it, what jokes yeah. don't make it. I don't really remember. Though there was John and I, Favreau would always joke that sort of like I tended to write meaner jokes mm-hmm. and David Axelrod tended to write more avuncular jokes. And John has a really great ability. John would write great jokes, but also have a really great ability to kind of find the best version of a joke as well. But I think a lot of times the best balance would be, and tons of other material, great material that would come in from all kinds of writers, all other, like, you know, professionals, other writers at the White House, a lot of people would contribute. But I think we always did the best when we struck a balance between the meaner stuff and the more avuncular stuff that could come from Axelrod, who was always also a great joke writer. John's joke was always that, to me, the ideal White House Correspondents' Dinner joke is just the president knocking the podium over and just saying, fuck you.
That's great. All right. Well, John, thank you so much for doing this today. And
Matt, I feel like roughly once a year, you find a different way for me to yell at you about various issues for about an hour. And sometimes you write it down. Sometimes it gets recorded. It's just a tradition that we have.
Well, I'm really glad that now everyone's going to get to hear it.
Sure.
And hopefully we can do it again sometime
Oh,
soon.
We didn't record it.
Oh, damn.
All right. Thanks,
All
Matt.
Right. Thank you. Thank you to John Lovett for being my guest on today's show. Check him out every week on Pod Save America and Love It or Leave It. And visit crooked.com/events to buy tickets to his upcoming live shows in Houston, Dallas, Austin, Minneapolis, and a lot more cities all across the country. If you enjoy this show, please tell your friends and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. The Last Laugh is distributed by Himalaya Media for The Daily Beast. It is produced by Jason Smith for Starburns Audio and Scott Porch for Himalaya Media. Special thanks to Crooked Media for letting us record at their studio and to Kyle Seglin for engineering this episode. Our music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.